I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. There are only two nations in the world that aren't part of the Paris Climate Agreement, Syria and Nicaragua. The U.S. could be the third, depending on whether or not President Trump decides to pull out of the agreement. He did promise that during his campaign. There's not a lot of incentive for countries to withdraw from the 2015 accord. Countries set their own goals. There aren't legal penalties for missing goals. And leaving the Paris Accord, some worry would mean the U.S. would lose its place at the table to negotiate global emissions standards. Leaving would be one of a number, really, of environmental practices under the Obama-era administration that the Trump administration is overturning. There are many others. We'll talk about them this hour. There have been big changes as well in the Environmental Protection Agency. Last week, several scientists were dismissed from a major EPA advisory board. A spokesperson for EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said that he might consider replacing the scientists with members from the industries that EPA regulates. So all of that is what we're going to be talking about this hour. Amy Harder is our guest, a reporter at Axios, where she covers energy policy and climate change. In the past, she has worked for the Wall Street Journal and also the National Journal. Amy, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. So is tomorrow the deadline? The climate talks end tomorrow, and we should be making a decision as to whether or not we're withdrawing from the accord, or what's the deadline here?
Well, the deadline right now is somewhat to be determined. Initially, the Trump administration had said that they want to make a decision by a G7 meeting next week in Italy. But a couple of weeks ago, they said that that meeting is that a decision on Paris is actually going to be delayed until a time that they did not specify. So right now, we really don't know. But I do think we will see some movement on this issue at the meeting where top Trump officials will be. And I think it'll give us some sense as to whether or not the administration will stay in or pull out. But as for an official decision, I think we just don't know that time yet.
I see. I guess a question I want to ask, rather than why would we be considering leaving, why is it that everybody has stayed except for Syria and Nicaragua? That's an incredible number of countries who are still in with the accord.
Right. Well, I mean, I certainly don't think there's going to be a mass exodus if the U.S. pulls out. I think the impact would be a little bit more subtle than that. But one reason why there's such broad support for this is that the Paris deal doesn't have a ton of really sharp teeth in terms of its impact. There's no legal requirement to cut greenhouse gas emissions. And instead, the only legal requirement is to really just be transparent with the progress as to what degree you are actually cutting emissions. And so given that sort of more conciliatory and less aggressive approach in the deal, it really made it easier for everybody to be a signatory on it compared to past deals where there was more teeth to the deal and therefore less broad participation.
So if we left, it wouldn't spell the end of the agreement, but what would it do?
Well, it would certainly be a big blow to the deal because the U.S. Under President Obama was really the key architect of this entire deal. Top Obama officials worked hard with officials from China and India, two of the biggest emitters in the world. China is the first, followed by the U.S., and then India is up there as well. And so getting those countries on board is really critical because they're in the future going to be the biggest emitters and have the fastest developing economies. So if the United States pulls out, it's going to weaken overall ambition of the deal. At least that's the conventional wisdom. I think there's sort of two schools of thought within the community of people who want the U.S. Who want to support the Paris deal, right, and support global climate change action. I think there's the more common school of thought, which is that if the U.S. pulls out, it will weaken ambition across the world. But then there's this other school of thought that actually says, well, if the U.S. stays in the deal, it could potentially do more damage to the climate deal from within instead of pulling out. So I think that's an internal debate you've seen among the people who support the Paris climate deal. And I think it remains to be seen what kind of impact the Trump administration would have on the deal if they stayed in. But it's safe to say that they will not be nearly as supportive of ambitious action on climate than President Obama was.
Mm-hmm. I was reading an interesting article, and I hadn't thought about this in this particular way before, that the richest countries have much of their economy in low-emitting sectors, in finance and technology, rather than in manufacturing. But when you look at developing countries in the world, they can't do that. So for them to really talk about cutting emissions is probably a much harder thing to do.
Correct. And I think, you know, the comments coming from countries, especially India, who, you know, is trying to get billions of people out of poverty, their priority, and you can't blame them, is to get those people out of poverty and into a place where they can have electricity. I think what President Obama and others have said is that what they hope India can do especially is to what's called leapfrogging over becoming dependent upon fossil fuels and going straight to renewable energy. Now, it might be perhaps even too late for that. India is really ramping up its coal production. In fact, the state-owned coal company in India has a coal production goal, meaning that they want to reach record amounts of production of coal, in part because it is often the most cheapest. Not always, but it certainly is in many places. And so I think you're seeing this tug of war with some countries like that. And I think you'll see that debate play out most acutely with India.
Yeah. What's happening with coal in the United States? The president, of course, had that press conference. He had miners with him. He talked about bringing clean coal jobs back. They're going to come back. Are they coming back?
They certainly are not coming back on any widespread scale, and they probably won't ever, or not any time in our lifetimes anyway. I think, and that's driven largely by a 1-2 punch, and I would say the first and the biggest punch is the market. Natural gas over the last decade has really boomed in the United States and replaced a lot of the coal in the electricity sector, and that's where a lot of the drop in coal-fired electricity has come because natural gas has replaced that. And that has happened regardless of what President Obama did. Now, the second punch, which is slightly smaller but still has had an impact, that is regulations that the EPA issued under President Obama. They have had an impact, and they are helping to cement the shift away from coal to natural gas. I think Trump might be able to have some impact on the edges of this industry. But coal executives I talk to are under no illusion that there's going to be this huge revival. But I think you will see some positive comments here and there. But overall, the coal industry is on a somewhat gradual downward trajectory. But, you know, we talk about coal going away in the U.S., but even the Obama EPA predicted out to 2030 that even under Obama's climate regulation, it's still predicted that coal would be 30% of U.S. electricity. So we talk about coal dying in the U.S., but it is far from that. It's just not quite the king coal that it was, say, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, compare that with India. It's 30% here, coal. How much in India?
I actually don't know what the percentage of coal-fired electricity is in India, but I know India wants to increase the amount of electricity it gets at all because so many people don't have reliable electricity, and one of their primary sources for that is going to be coal.
Mm-hmm. You wrote recently about the administration's plan to slash renewables 70%. They want to cut Energy Department's renewable and energy efficiency program by nearly 70%. Congress probably won't grant such deep cuts, but the numbers are important. It puts a low marker down to negotiate with Congress. I thought renewables were a burgeoning industry in this country now, aren't they?
They certainly are. Wind and solar in particular have been really growing a lot over the last 8 to 9 years, largely thanks to some of the policies that President Obama implemented. But it's important to separate out, you know, the general growth of some of these industries to the budget. Now, the people I talk to in the renewable energy space, both in the solar and wind primarily, which is where most of the U.S. electricity in the renewable space comes from, they talk about how there's really not that much Trump can do to really knock down the industry writ large very much. But that being said, a lack of funding and a lack of organizational focus on some of these technologies could hamper some even earlier technology, such as offshore wind, for example, or small-scale hydropower, things like that, that really do need government support right now, and they might not get it. They probably won't get much of it for the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Another thing, and I'm wondering, this seems like something that the administration wouldn't be doing because they would be more in favor of fossil fuel and nuclear funding. So help us understand what you've written about. There is a plan on the part of the administration to cut fossil fuel, to cut nuclear funding, to cut the Energy Department's offices for nuclear power and fossil fuel energy by, and this seems substantial to me, 21% and 54%.
Right. Those are substantial. I think they reveal a couple of things. Number one, the Trump administration is serious about trying to make significant reforms to the federal government's spending habits. And all of these offices that we're talking about for the renewables and energy efficiency and nuclear energy and fossil fuels, these are all to invest in new technologies, whether it's to burn coal more cleanly or to make small reactors in the nuclear space. So the reason why, so 21% is 31% for the nuclear office is quite a bit, but actually it's the least cut among all these others. So I suppose it doesn't make the industry very happy. The nuclear industry was just trying to revive itself after decades of being stuck in neutral, but actually it's not as bad as the cuts for the other offices. And I think that's It's a sign of how the Trump administration is trying to have it both ways, and I think as I reported, it shows the hypocrisy of the rhetoric of backing up clean coal jobs and the nuclear renaissance, and then cutting funding for it. And I heard some people who are in the industries of these two sectors who are saying that as well, perhaps a little bit more politely than I, as a reporter, said it, but nonetheless, they think the Trump administration needs to support these causes. I would note that any administration budget never goes into law as it's written, but again, it's an important starting point. And for a new administration, I think it shows a lot about their priorities.
Mm. Let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our guest is Amy Harder, a reporter at Axios, where she covers energy policy and climate change. And she's written extensively about a number of different areas. We're looking at, well, we'll talk more about regulations. And there is a pushback on the part of some people who are in industry who think that maybe the pushback on some of these regulations, deregulations, is going a bit too far. We're talking about the Paris Climate Agreement and whether or not the administration will pull out of that agreement. Renewables, we're discussing that, the use of coal. And we will talk more about what's happened with the Environmental Protection Agency as we carry on here. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can send an email, talk@WPR.org. You can go to Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Mike in Madison is our first caller for you. Amy, hello, Mike.
Hi, I'm really afraid that this discussion has underestimated the crisis situation that we face. Every single day, the world does not reduce its daily emissions of greenhouse gases. They build up to higher and higher levels in the atmosphere. They are irreversible. And the chief culprits are the military, the meat industry, and transportation by all of us, especially jet traffic. And I just can't believe that we're going to delay more. That delay is taking an action. People have been fighting for this for 25 years, and it just keeps building up.
Amy?
Yeah, I mean, Mike, you make some great points. I certainly think you share the viewpoint of a lot of people in this country who acknowledge the scientific consensus, and there is a scientific consensus, of course, that human activity is helping and is the primary contributor to the Earth's rising temperature. I think with Trump winning the election, I think it had a huge impact on whether or not this country will address climate change, at least in the next 4 years. I think it will be interesting to see, you know, I think one of my rules of thumb for this year is not to make any assumptions. And I think with Trump in the White House, he might be a little bit more unconventional on this issue than we've seen perhaps Senator Cruz would have been if he would have won the election. So I think your concern is shared by a lot of people. It is certainly a serious issue that Washington really hasn't addressed in any seriousness since 2010. I talk quite often about this issue from a broad perspective with a lot of people in Washington. And, you know, there is an effort underway in the conservative side of Washington to try to build support for climate change within the Republican Party, which, frankly, most elected members of Congress don't acknowledge that climate change is a problem at all. I'm going to have an upcoming piece next week that really looks at a lot of this. So I do think there is some movement efforts in Washington and around the country to address climate change. But I think there's no masking also the fact that with Trump in the White House, it will probably delay action. Now, that being said, climate change is a very long-term problem. So changes on a presidential basis of 4 to 8 years probably won't necessarily be the tipping point because there's never, you know, a black and white moment when it becomes too late. But nonetheless, I think you're going to hear people like you be louder and louder as we get closer to election season.
Do you think there is a tipping point on this, Amy?
I think, you know, I don't think there's one clear tipping point for something that, you know, for something as complicated as climate change. You know, there's been an interesting debate about, you know, the uncertainty of climate change and how bad the impacts are going to be. A lot of the scientists I talk to and other experts, they say somewhere between bad and worse. And I agree with that. I don't think there's going to be a year or a point at which people are just going to throw up their hands and be like, well, if it's too late to do anything, so we might as well forget about it. I don't think it'll ever be like that. I certainly think there probably could be more attention paid to adapting to climate change. Right now, there's so much talk and all the political controversies hung up in what's called a mitigating climate change, mm-hmm. right? So stopping the burning of carbon emissions. But even if we stopped burning carbon emissions tomorrow, the impacts of a warmer planet are already locked in for centuries. So that's why I think there needs to be, and I suspect probably will be in the years and decades to come, more political attention to adapting to it, because we are seeing warmer temperatures and heat waves and stronger storms, and those cost the government and others money. And I think there needs to be a more holistic approach on that. And I think we'll see that more in the coming years.
Well, the other thing that we've seen is really an increase in the number of people just marching in the streets on these issues. I mean, who'd have thought you'd have a march for scientists, a march for science? There have been climate change marches. People are upset about this.
They are. I mean, I think you've seen record amounts of fundraising by a lot of the environmental groups because, you know, in the wake of Trump, because a lot of people are understandably worried about how this issue is going to fare under Trump. And I know we're going to get into some of these other issues, but, you know, climate change is certainly the biggest and most comprehensive environmental problem the planet faces. But there are a lot of other more sort of conventional environmental issues that I think some people are worried about under Trump.
Right.
And I think you're seeing a lot of attention paid to that as well, which is why you're seeing more attention and more fundraising and more membership going to some of these causes. You know, my piece next week is going to look at how there's even been an increase in some interest in these conservative groups that are backing climate change. And that's because, you know, it's sort of a natural feeling when you're faced with a resistance, it sort of awakens the fire in some people. And I think you're seeing that with Trump on this particular issue of climate change and the environment.
Well, we'll take more phone calls in a moment and move on to other issues relating to the environment this hour of the program. Our guest is Amy Harter, reporter at Axios, and covers environmental issues pretty thoroughly. As you can tell, our number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Nate is our next caller in Madison. Hi, Nate.
Thanks. I just wondered if these, first of all, I have a comment and a question. My comment is, I don't think any of us should be very surprised, those of us who think seriously about politics and issues and our country's future, that the administration doesn't have much credibility on anything that's said in the campaign cycle. So to move on to my more specific question is, I'm wondering if the speaker has any insight into specific strategy to target or to try to persuade specific, and I guess in this case, Republican. There are some Democratic legislators like Joe Manchin that would also need to be persuaded. If there's a strategy to persuade people to get on board with a more long-term view of preserving our resources and preserving our environment.
Great. Well, Nate, thanks for your question. You know, I think that's, you know, a hot topic, no pun intended, here in Washington about how to bridge the very big gap that exists between a lot of the Democrats, most of the Democrats, who think climate change is a big problem, and most of the Republican Party who doesn't. Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, is an interesting case study, and I'll just briefly talk about him because he acknowledges the scientific consensus of climate change, which I think is an important point, because if you don't think there's a problem, then you don't need to talk about how to solve it. But nonetheless, Senator Manchin is concerned about any sort of solution, policy solution to that. So I think, without giving advice per se, I mean, I think it's going to be important, especially in this new era with President Trump, I think it's going to be important to try to talk about climate change in a way that is more business friendly. And in fact, it's a story I had a few weeks ago. One of my first pieces here at Axios was about how corporate America is actually more united on climate change than it's been in a decade. You even have coal companies who want to stay in the Paris deal. Not necessarily because, or perhaps probably not at all because they want to save the planet, but because they see the world moving in a direction of restraining carbon emissions, and they don't want to be on the table. They don't want to be on the menu, so they want to be at the table negotiating. And so I think you're seeing some of this impact in the corporate America backing climate change. I think you're seeing that start to leak into Congress and have an impact on some of these members. But I think it's important to be able to speak the language of the relative parties. And right now, even though Democrats don't like it, Republicans control the House and the Senate and the White House. And so I think it's important to not, at least from the Democratic side, not constantly talk about how the sky is falling and how if we don't cut carbon emissions tomorrow and end all fossil fuels, then we can't do anything. Because that type of conversation doesn't, it just shuts people off on the Republican side. And so I think the Republicans I talk to, you know, they try to talk about climate change from a direction that is more conservative friendly. Now, perhaps that's not what the science compels, but that is what politics compels. And I think that's an important distinction in Washington. Sometimes the scientific facts need to be handled in a way that is more politically friendly. And I think, you know, the challenge has perhaps gotten more difficult with Trump. But then again, the status quo under President Obama wasn't really conducive to bipartisan policy on climate change. And it would have continued that way under Clinton. So some people think that Trump is shaking up the status quo in a way that perhaps the chips could fall in a position that makes it, you know, more beneficial to climate policy. I don't think we'll see any sort of movement until at least after the 2018 midterm election.
Well, who knows what you're going to see in this country before then, and a whole host of issues as well. I'm wondering if you see, considering the fact that this administration has been in so much turmoil in the first few months, do you think that things will settle down a little bit now and people will be able to proceed on environmental matters and many others now that at least there's a special prosecutor here?
Yeah, you know, that my motto I keep coming back to is no assumptions, and so I'm certainly no expert on the Russia story. But you make a good point, because no policy lives in a vacuum, mm-hmm. and I think even before all of this drama over the Russian investigation, even on the campaign trail, EPA and climate issues were not a top-tier issue at all.
Right.
As somebody who covers this issue, I need to be humble about that. And I think even in the best-case scenario, this White House doesn't particularly care to make this a priority. So I think in the next few months, I don't anticipate seeing a lot of action in the White House or in Congress on this. I think any action, if it comes, will be in 2018. Mm. But I don't even know what kind of action that would look like. Mm-hmm. I think you're seeing a lot of regulatory rollbacks at EPA, and I think there's some questions there. But in terms of any offensive, like, sort of proactive climate legislation, I think the chances of that happening are very slim. I think it's next to zero before 2018. And then after 2018, I mean, perhaps it goes up to 5%. Mm. But I think most of the discussion is going to be about how far back does Trump want to go in repealing these regulations mm-hmm. that were issued during the Obama term.
Nate, thanks for your call. We go to Tashi in Madison. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say, not just here in the U.S., it affects, economically, people are getting smarter here in this country, and they're more educated compared to developing country. And then once, all these big corporate figure out, like, it's harder for them to do business here, they go, to country like China, India, and, some other Southeast Asia. Me being a descendant, my parents are from Tibet, and we came here, like, about 20 years ago or so. So I grew up here, like, half of my life, and I grew up in India in a refugee camp half of my life.
Oh.
And, as you guys probably know, like, a couple of the delegates went to Tibet, Nancy Pelosi, a couple months ago, and then they recently visited Dalai Lama in India. And, Tibet has a lot of issues, not just human rights. Climate, like, I mean, half of the population reside in Southeast Asia or around Asia. And, our grassland in Tibet is turning into desert because, the Chinese government is making nomads settle permanently. And now they can grass their cattle and all that stuff is affecting. And then, building a huge amount of hydro dam upstream in Tibet, where all the major river in Southeast Asia starts, mm-hmm. Making, all these big corporation stuff like Walmart to Apple product without any regulation. And, it, believe it or not, it does affect here. I mean, everybody looks for cheap stuff, but smogs are coming to California. There's acid rain over here. How should we, regulate some of these international corporates that are building stuff over there because they can't, because of all the regulation that we have here, they can't do certain things. But then when you go to country like China or like India or like some other Southeast Asia, like Vietnam or something, mm-hmm. they can do pretty much whatever they like because...
What about international regulations on companies? Is there anybody looking at that? Is that a big issue? Who takes the lead here, Amy?
Well, I mean, I think we'll see that play out in the context of the Paris climate deal.
Right.
If the U.S. pulls out, I think there's the prospect of a border tariff war in some respects. I think you've seen some officials in countries in Europe, for example, sort of float the idea that if the U.S. pulls out, we need to make some sort of mechanism to make sure that they're accounting for products that are made in a country that isn't addressing climate change. And I think that's something that we'll see play out over the next months and years. I don't know if climate change right in this moment is going to prompt a trade war. I think that might be a little bit too extreme for this moment, but the caller was bringing up some good points to underscore, you know, how this is a global issue.
Yes.
And, of course, people around the world are being affected by it, even more perhaps than people in the U.S. I mean, low-lying nations in the South Pacific, for example, and heat waves in India and things like that. I mean, those are really the front lines of climate change. Now, I don't think it's a secret that this new administration has a policy that really puts America first, as President Trump says a lot. So I don't think those types of arguments, unfortunately, it's not something that would necessarily resonate with this administration, not because they don't care about people in other countries. I think they do. But it's not a priority for them. That was a campaign point that Trump made on the campaign trail, and it is something he continues to focus on in the White House. So from what I understand, the people that I talk to in the administration who even want to stay in the Paris deal, they're not talking about staying in the Paris deal and why it's good for the rest of the world. They're talking about why staying in the Paris deal would help ensure U.S. companies remain competitive with their counterparts in countries like China. So even though climate change is a very big issue and of a concern for, you know, everybody around the world, that type of argument is not one that I think would resonate all that much in the Trump administration, given the public rhetoric that they have made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it would have been totally different under President Clinton if she had won, or, you know, how it was under Obama. But I don't think those types of comments are going to be the tipping point in terms of helping the administration decide whether or not they stay or leave the Paris deal.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch to another topic related field, the environment. The EPA dismissing members of a major scientific review board. Please tell me more about this board. At least five members of a major scientific review board. So they have been shrinking the agency's regulatory reach by reducing the role of academic research. Evidently, the administration believes that people should be on the board who understand the impact of regulations on the regulated community.
Yeah, I think this move was or is emblematic of just how different this administration wants to lead the government compared to the Obama administration. And it is certainly out of norm. And, you know, one could go so far to say, you know, troubling to see that to see these scientists getting, asked to leave early. I think we'll want to wait and see the types of people that they replace it with. Again, as a reporter, you know, I want to make sure I'm never jumping to conclusions or making assumptions that I shouldn't be. But nonetheless, this type of move is quite significant. And given the administration's comments about EPA in general, the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has focused very much so on repealing regulations as opposed to protecting the environment, that I think moves like this continue to sort of cloud the public's perception of the new EPA.
Well, Itachi, thanks for the call. Mary is next in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Oh, I was wondering about the ethos of Europe of having maybe one child per couple. Is that true?
Well, I think the one child per couple rule, where did you say?
In Europe.
Oh, I don't think I'm familiar with that particular policy, but generally speaking, the topic of how over, you know, population control as a means to address climate change is one of the most controversial issues that I've never personally written about it. But one time I tweeted about it. It was an NPR story, a very well done story, and I just tweeted about it, and it provoked so much controversy just to tweet
really?
It. Just the idea that, you know, people should have to not have so many children as a way to address climate change is what I might call a third rail of this issue. I mean, even most environmental groups that want to get off all fossil fuels by 2050 won't say publicly anyway that they think people should not have as many kids. Now, you know, as a reporter, I try to see all sides, and what I'm about to say is not something I support or not support, but you know, one was, I mean, the use of the burning of fossil fuels is burned by humans. So one would think if you had fewer people, you would have less of a problem with climate change. And that's the reasoning that these people, it's a small kind of group of experts in the country that are trying to talk about population control as a solution. Now, I certainly don't support that or not support that. I don't have a position on it. But nonetheless, it's very controversial and something that I think perhaps will become more a part of the debate in the years to come, right, as the science gets clearer and the impacts become clearer, it might become a bigger issue. But I don't think here in the United States, I don't think that would ever become a seriously considered policy.
Mm. Thanks very much for the call. Are there other areas that we should move into? I know that you write extensively about so many areas of environmental concern. Can we talk about deregulation a little bit more broadly, Amy? Have there been industries that have been significantly deregulated already? Are there concerns about the fracking industry, other industries in this country that have environmental impact and regulations have been softened?
Yeah, well, the Trump administration has taken many, many steps, many first steps, I would say, to begin the very long and likely litigious, going to be sued by environmental groups, I'm sure, across the board to unravel a lot of what President Obama did in the 8 years he was in office. I think the specific impacts on the energy industry have so far been limited because it's only been a few months. And really all that the Trump administration has done mostly, now this isn't the case in every single incident, but more likely it has been that Trump has signed executive orders that has ordered agencies to begin the process. So that's really where we're at. The EPA is looking at how far back it wants to repeal some of these regulations. And I had a piece earlier this week looking at how the industry is ironically becoming this countervailing influence within the Republican Party and within the Trump administration to actually urge them not to repeal too many regulations, because business, more than anything, they like certainty. And repealing too many regulations could result in two things. One, losing in court, which creates more uncertainty, or the next president deciding that that was too extreme of a measure and that president then repealing it themselves and changing it again. So those are the two things industry wants to avoid. A perfect example of this is the auto fuel efficiency standard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, President Trump has said he wants to redo and review a midterm review that Obama rushed in the last couple of weeks of in office. He did rush it by a year and a half. It was a midterm review of these fuel economy standards that was not supposed to be done until April 2018. So Trump said he wants to review these, but in the rhetoric of his and other top officials, he made it seem as if he wanted to get rid of the entire fuel economy standards. Now these fuel economy standards are embedded in law as well as EPA regulations, and so he really can't get rid of them without an act of Congress. But even so, the automakers don't want him to get rid of the fuel economy standards that Obama ramped up. They just want him to redo this review and maybe make it a little bit lower, but there's not going to be a huge change in trajectory. And, you know, they also don't want Trump to revoke a waiver that California received to issue more aggressive standards. And that's because if California has this waiver go away, it will be sued, and then there'll be all this uncertainty, and these automakers have to make cars all over the U.S. and all over the world. And the last thing they want is lawsuits tying them up for years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good example, and you're seeing that play out in a number of different places where the industry certainly wants to take advantage of this opportunity, but they don't want Trump to get too carried away.
What about regulations that many in the industry have felt are onerous, and they welcome them being lifted?
Right. Well, there is an ongoing debate about how or whether the U.S. government should regulate emissions of methane. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, much more potent than carbon dioxide. And it's emitted, methane is the primary component of natural gas. And so it's emitted sometimes inadvertently when oil and gas is produced. And there's a large number of companies that don't want the federal government to regulate methane at all. And then there's a few bigger, most of the bigger companies like BP and Shell actually do want some level of moderate regulation. But that's, this effort or this example is shows how some companies don't want any regulation and others do. I can't think of a regulation that everybody is pushing to get rid of. You know, Obama's carbon rule for power plants, I don't think there's necessarily any companies out there urging Trump to keep it, as some companies have done with, for example, the auto standards. So that's an example of one where the industry is like, well, okay, we support Trump getting rid of the Clean Power Plan, which is Obama's rule. But they, again, going back to my point about cautioning them going too far, most of industry think that there should be some sort of carbon regulation because a Supreme Court ruling from 2007 really compels it.
We're welcoming more phone calls. Here's how you reach our conversation. We're talking about a variety of environmental issues, starting the hour with whether or not the president will withdraw the United States from the global Paris climate agreement. Those talks end tomorrow, and there should be a decision, as the president promised on the campaign trail, that we would withdraw from that accord. But we're looking at a broad range of environmental policy issues this hour of the program. Amy Harder is our guest. Amy is a reporter at Axios. She covers energy policy and climate change. She has previously worked for the Wall Street Journal and also the National Journal. And here's how you reach our conversation in the remaining minutes. There's time for you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Richard in Milwaukee is next. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering what your guest thinks about China's move to be number one in solar energy technology, and whether you think the Trump administration, being business-oriented, might seize upon the all the idea of developing solar power as a business opportunity in the United States and trying to compete with the Chinese so that they don't take the total world market on it.
I think that's a great question. Thanks for it, Richard. I think that is certainly the type of argument that I see resonating more with this administration as opposed to the sort of moral leadership on climate change that resonated more with the Obama administration. I think this idea of competitiveness, U.S. competitiveness versus other countries, versus other companies in other countries is going to be key. You'll notice, you might recall on the campaign trail, the one thing that Trump was consistent with regarding the Paris deal was that he thought the deal hurt U.S. companies versus, for example, China. I think in 2012, going back in time, in 2012, he tweeted that climate change was a hoax created by the Chinese to make U.S. manufacturing less competitive. So I think, and you've heard him say that during the campaign and then since he's been president. So I think that's part of the arguments that people within the White House and those outside of it, the business leaders, are making to him, that if the U.S. pulls out of the Paris deal, or even if the U.S. stays in the Paris deal and sort of significantly scales back its ambition, that China is going to step into that void and is in some ways already stepping in to take the lead on things like solar and nuclear power and technology to burn coal more cleanly, where you capture the carbon and then you store it underground instead of emitting it. China is advancing on all of these fronts from a technological perspective, in part because they have such a growing population and need for electricity that that's what it calls for. And so I think this is going to be a key area, whether it's solar or nuclear power. I think all of these things are going to be points in the discussion about whether or not to stay in. And then if they do stay in, you know, how they talk about it as part of a renegotiation. Because I think it's important that even if the U.S. stays in, if Trump decides to stay in the deal, that there is consensus within the White House that the pledge that Obama committed to needs to be rejiggered or thrown out altogether. And so to the extent that that happens, this discussion of competitiveness on all these energy technologies is going to be essential, I think.
And you wonder, I've always wondered China's change in course here. You look at the horrible, horrible smog in Chinese cities, so people could hardly work. It looked like it was 2 o'clock in the morning at noon. The smog was so awful. You can't have a country operate. People have to be able to go to work. I've always wondered in the United States, what does it take for people to realize that these issues are real? And for a while you think, well, it's the horrible hurricanes, and it's what's happened in New York. It certainly is what happened in New Orleans. We're seeing more of these storms. But it seems as though China saw something and said, we've got to do something.
Right. I mean, I think you saw that play out on a different type of scale. You know, in the 60s, the U.S. had really bad air quality, and that led in part to the creation of the EPA in 1970 by President Nixon, a Republican. So I think you're seeing that sort of debate, you know, that sort of public outcry for action by the government playing out in China. And it just so happens that the poor air quality in China is happening at a time that the rest of the world, including China, is increasingly aware of the concerns of climate change. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit ironic, but the traditional air quality issues is creating awareness for climate change in a way that is no longer present in the U.S. because we have a lot of these traditional air pollution protections already in place. And I think, you know, there's this whole body of work on the psychological problems of communicating about climate change. It's really quite fascinating if you want to get really down in the weeds on it. But even a hurricane or a storm here and there, I mean, they do a lot of damage in the moment. And for some people, their lives are changed forever. But for most people, you see it on the news and then you carry on a few days later. And so I think it's hard to see how climate change impacts you on a day-to-day basis compared to, say, a lack of health care or, a gay couple who can't get married and now they can because gay marriage is legal, things like that. Other issues that are considered, you know, have been considered social issues that you've seen progress on. You don't see that on climate change, in part because there's not as much immediate impact on most people's daily lives.
Thanks, Richard. Jeff is probably our last call in Medford. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen?
Fine, Jeff. How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to kind of, you and the guests, why we don't look more at personal lifestyles. We always look to government regulations. Why don't we look at education and teaching people how to better have a life without electricity and other types of things? And I'm talking about huge things like sports events and all kinds of things like that that use huge amounts of electricity, or even concerts in your the Hollywood elites and stuff. Why don't we focus on some of the reduction of the things like that and then get people, like the earlier call talked about, making cheap, inexpensive things overseas and then bringing them here for low cost. Why don't we teach people to put their lifestyle and their money where their mouth is and change their lifestyles and change their spending habits versus always looking to the government to deregulate something, because the businesses are just going to go where the money's at.
About 45 seconds, Amy.
Well, that's a great question, and certainly the million-dollar one. I think a lot of people, I think it's a combination of two things. One, I think a lot of people feel a little helpless. They feel like, oh, I'm going to try to recycle, and I'm going to walk to work instead of drive. But the world is such a massive place that they feel like it's not going to make a difference. And I think that's oftentimes why most people think that it needs to be a government-level response to such a broad problem. But I think you're seeing smaller movements on a more personal level here and there, especially with Trump in the White House. I do think you're seeing movements with people trying to make more of a difference on a local and individual level, because there's going to be little action at the U.S. government level.
Amy, thank you so much. You're a great guest. Thanks for covering so many issues.
Well, it's great to be on here. Thanks so much.
Sure. Amy Harder, she's a reporter at Axios, A-X-I-O-S, where you should go because she covers a wide range of not only climate change issues, but energy policy issues as well. And she has worked for the Wall Street Journal and also for the National Journal. Thanks so much to Colleen Leahy for producing the hour, Gretchen Brown for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be with you again on Monday next time for All Things Political.